comes the big dog. The big dog, Roman Reigns. And we kick off Monday Night Raw live tonight in Phoenix, Arizona with the big dog. Big dog eats my ass.
It's business time, baby.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
My client.
Mama Monster.
Conquered the street.
You like fighting a woman?
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
Come over here and fight me.
Delete. You haven't been beat up properly.
Welcome to episode 597 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, April 28th, 2019. I am the Solid Monster. The NWA was back last night with the Crockett Cup. I have not had a chance to watch it yet, but I heard it was a good show. A lot of praise for Jim Cornette's commentary. I'm sure he was right in his element there. They even got Tommy Young to referee the main event for the NWA title between Nick Aldis and Marty Scurll. He has not officiated many matches since he broke his neck back in 1989. But what Earl Hebner was to WWE, Tommy Young was to the NWA back in the day. Two men that belong in the Hall of Fame. So that was nice to see. I won't give away any of the results for people who still might want to watch it, but they really, from what I read and what I see them doing, and I saw the images, they really went all out to make it look like an authentic NWA show from back in the mid-80s. They even had the old, you know, NWA-style ring skirt. It was pretty cool, and you know, they seem to be borrowing from a lot of what worked in the past and incorporating those elements in with a more modern approach. With they have their 10 pounds of gold series on YouTube that really helps build up their key matches and makes them feel more like a sport, which is, I think, what we need to see more of in wrestling today. I think some of their thunder's been stolen away by All Elite Wrestling and all the hoopla around that and the Double or Nothing show. Rumors of a big TV deal and all that. But don't sleep on the NWA. You know, they're trying to bring back some of what made wrestling so enjoyable to a lot of people back 30 years ago and just rekindle some of that magic. You know, the NWA is not going to be what it used to be because what it is now is not the same thing. But Billy Corgan's an old school wrestling fan. He's an old school wrestling guy, and that shines through with a lot of what he and Dave Lagana are doing now with the NWA. So don't sleep on that. If you want to support the podcast, there are a bunch of different ways to do so. Audible being chief among them, you can use our Audible link and get yourself one free audiobook. If you sign up for a 30-day trial of the service, all you got to do is use the link audibletrial.com/solomonster. Diamond Dallas Page, who I've had on this podcast before, he has a book out. A new book out called Positively Unstoppable, The Art of Owning It. You can get it for free right now on Audible when you sign up for a trial using our link. And he talks about how to follow your dreams and your goals. And he includes a sample workout. There's eating plans in there, recipes. You can get the book for free. Even if you cancel in those first 30 days, you get to keep it. Audibletrial.com/Solomonster. I am planning to get back into DDP yoga, which I guess is DDPY now. When I was doing it, it helped me. And then I stopped. I hurt my knee last year. It still hurts when I kneel on it, right on the scar. I don't think that's probably ever going to go away at this point. It's been 11 months. It's going to be a year. But I am planning on getting back into it soon. I remember, it's funny, you know, back when I was doing it, I was having a lot of trouble. The one thing I always had an issue with when I was doing those workouts was getting my heart rate up. Because as you're really getting into it and increasing the intensity and you're gripping your toes and all of these different things into the mat, you're supposed to look at your heart rate monitor and your heart rate is supposed to get all jacked up. And I always had issues getting my heart rate up at a level that I thought it should be at. And it was really starting to piss me off. It was really starting to frustrate me. And I remember I'm waiting at the bus stop one night after work. I'm waiting to go home. All of a sudden my phone rings and it's DDP. And he's like, "Oh, I hear you having trouble with your heart rate." And he's telling me, you know, "You got to plant those fucking toes, bro. You got to plant those toes." And I'm just standing there in the middle of Fifth Avenue thinking like, is this real life? Like, what is going on here? And even after that, I still had some problems. I'm digging those toes into the ground so hard, I cramped up. So hopefully this time around, I'll have an easier time getting that heart rate up. If you want to become a PayPal VIP, you can do so. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname and a shout-out. You can go to thesolomonster.com. That is the place to go. You can make your donation there. Or if you want to do it, I guess you could do it via email. Thesolomonster@gmail.com is the place to send that to. Thank you to the Portland pop star Paul Hamilton, Chuck Lunatic Lentz, John Loose Cannon Lopez, Deadpool James Herrera, the Florida Freebird Brian Becerra, Beast Mode Brock Joseph, Luis Hercules Hernandez, Death Row or Death Blow. I don't know. What would be a cooler name there? Death Row or Death Blow? We'll go with Death Blow. David Floyd, thank you. Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, Brian the Cleaver Carpenter, the Anarchist Andrew Heller, the Chicago Slayer Willie Eichard, Stephen Handyman Halistick, Danger Dan Larson, Recon Russell Bulware, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine Harrison Soep, and also a happy 21st birthday to Zach All Systems Go Modrak from his girlfriend the Nitta Ninja. Ren McFadden, his birthday was yesterday. Hopefully you have recovered by now. Joey Scherer, I hear you like my show. I like that you like my show. And I'd like to thank you for liking my show. Rodney Hot Rod Cologne, who, how appropriate this weekend with Endgame coming out, runs his own comic book themed YouTube channel called Just a Rican and His Comics. He does live shows every Saturday and Sunday, free giveaways every month, along with comic reviews from Marvel, DC, and some indies. Go to YouTube, type in Just a Rican, R-I-C-A-N, and it'll be the first thing that comes up. He's got old school comics, too, that he gives away each month. So if you're into that and you're a collector, definitely check his channel out. And also, shout out to Lame Ass Fan, SB Life, G4 Tro, and Zappidos on iTunes for the love on there. Thank you guys so much. If you don't think that WWE has a bee in its bonnet about All Elite Wrestling, well, you're an idiot. We saw more evidence of that this week. First, with The Undertaker and Kurt Angle both being pulled from StarCast 2 in Las Vegas, which is running the same weekend as the AEW Double or Nothing show. It's not an AEW-affiliated event, per se, although it is unofficially linked to everything that is going on that weekend, and much of the AEW talent will be appearing at StarCast. Sports Illustrated broke the story about Undertaker and Kurt Angle being pulled. They interviewed Conrad Thompson about it. He is organizing the event, as he did the first StarCast last year. In the interest of full disclosure, I was contacted about being part of StarCast last year and this year. Last year I couldn't make the trip. And this year, I will be there as a fan. I will be there as a fan. I don't have the time to dedicate to doing a live show and all that, so I decline. But I am looking forward to going and hopefully seeing some of you there. This is like a mini Vegas vacation for me, since WrestleMania this year was in the shadow of New York City. Sorry, all you Jersey dwellers. So I didn't get to travel anywhere, so this is my trip. This and the Jericho Cruise are going to be my trips between this year and next year. But anyway, SI, they talked to Conrad, and he said that Undertaker was officially booked, and a deposit was made. Once the announcement was made, he heard that Vince McMahon texted the Undertaker. I just love this image in my head of Vince McMahon furiously texting the Undertaker to find out more about this. And then shortly thereafter, Undertaker's reps got in touch with Conrad and said, look, he can't do it. WWE says he can't do it. Of course, I hear that. I think independent contractor, my ass. They at least returned the deposit to Conrad. He said that he had a friend tell him. A friend talked about things with Vince McMahon. I do wonder if this friend's name rhymes with Dick Nair, which sounds like a terrible idea when I say that out loud. Don't do that. He was told that the damages would be covered, a suitable replacement would be offered, and some sort of compromise would be made, though, either way, to make everybody happy. And I don't know if this is it. This might be part of it. But they did later announce that Tom McGee is coming to StarCast. Yes, Tom McGee is going to be that suitable replacement for The Undertaker. Anyway, Tom McGee is going to be at StarCast for a panel with Bret Hart, where they are going to be talking about their infamous WWF match over 30 years ago that never aired. I don't know if this includes a screening of the match itself. The Observer says it does, and that WWE, as part of this make-good, is allowing them to show the footage, which is really, other than the person who recently unearthed it, and Bret Hart himself, nobody's really seen this footage. And supposedly WWE, as part of this make-good, is going to let them screen the match for everybody in attendance, and then the two of them are going to talk about it after the fact. I don't know if that's the case or not. That's what the Observer said in this little preview trailer that StarCast put together for it. I don't believe there was a mention of a screening, so I guess we'll find out. But that is part of what StarCast is now offering in place of losing these big names. And look, if it's part of WWE's make good, then that's cool and all. But if it's not, then expect WWE to go ahead and sign Tom McGee to a Legends deal as soon as possible so they can bar him from showing up. And let's be honest, when I say that, you really can't be sure if that's true or not, right? You could totally see them doing that. In the article, Conrad says that he suggested Vince himself, or Stephanie, or Triple H as a replacement, with 100% of the proceeds generated being donated to Connor's Cure, which of course is the charity that was set up by Triple H and Stephanie. They've raised millions of dollars for it. It's, you know, very near and dear to their heart. And so 100% of the profits made here would go to Connor's Cure, and Conrad claims that he would also match that donation personally. So there would be a lot of money going to Connor's Cure if they got any of the McMahons to do this. He was told that Vince McMahon would not allow any main roster replacements, including himself. And look, I'm sure when he pitched that idea, he knew it was a Hail Mary. I mean, of the three, maybe Stephanie might have been the most likely. I mean, Vince is always busy. Triple H, I'm sure, is busy. But, you know, look, stranger things have happened. In the name of charity, stranger things have happened. I don't fault him for going ahead and making the suggestion, because you don't know unless you ask, right? How do you know? How do you know what the answer is going to be unless you ask the question? But he was turned down. And so instead, he went after Shawn Michaels. He was going to have Shawn Michaels replace The Undertaker and do a panel where he and Scott Hall would do commentary for the 25th anniversary of their ladder match at WrestleMania 10. So far, he's heard nothing back. He's been checking in daily now for over a week, and nothing, nada. And this is on the heels of The Undertaker pulling out of a series of spoken word events that he was set to do in the UK this week with the Inside the Ropes folks. They're calling it the Rise of the Taker Tour. They have dates Monday in Manchester, Tuesday in London, Wednesday in Glasgow. It's sold out, and it was supposed to be a series of Q&As, sit-down Q&As with The Undertaker, plus a meet-and-greet. Undertaker has landed in the UK. He is there. He is committed to doing the meet-and-greet, but he was forced out of the Q&As by WWE because of pressure from WWE. So the people who paid good money, ridiculous money in some cases, to go see The Undertaker, tell stories and answer questions, fan questions, were basically screwed over by WWE. And Undertaker was really upset. He was adamant. Apparently, he went to bat with Vince and WWE that he at least be able to fly over and do the meet and greets, and that was a whole challenge. But they acquiesced and they said fine. So, you know, look, credit to The Undertaker at least for fighting for that and still flying all the way over there. But just again, WWE being dicks about it and applying pressure to make sure he didn't do it. And as a replacement, they got Mick Foley to step in his place and do the Q&As. But that's after a lot of personal lobbying from The Undertaker, who was unequivocally told, no, you cannot do the Q&As. And it maybe it's in the new contract. Supposedly, he signed some kind of new deal relatively recently with WWE, a new contract. And maybe it's in the contract that he cannot do appearances like these, or that they at least have to first be approved by WWE. But that's how much control. That is how much control that they have over these things. So when you hear people talk about, you know, especially coming off the John Oliver piece on HBO about the independent contractor farce, which a lot of people, like myself, I've been talking about that for years. I've called it a farce. But when you hear people talking about it, because now they just apply that to everything. Every situation where WWE is the big bad villain, oh, independent contractor. And you can't always use that argument, right? And in this case, legally, they may be able to do all of this, but this is another great example of what a frickin' farce, even just the mere notion is, that they could take somebody like The Undertaker, who isn't even really an active full-time member of the roster anymore and hasn't been in a very long time, started to go out and make his own appearances with his own representatives, his own people, being told, no, you can't do it. Daddy says no. Go stand in the corner. Now, Conrad says he had an agreement in place with the talent. He dealt directly with the talent, or he dealt with their management. They set the terms. He followed through, including first-class travel, the whole nine yards. And thanks to WWE, he says, the performers lose out on what he calls substantial income, and the fans are being punished as a result. He says he's still searching for big names to bring in. In fact, the next day, he announced that Japanese legend Kenta Kobashi is coming to StarCast. That's going to be Kenta Kobashi's first appearance on U.S. soil since his Ring of Honor match with Samoa Joe back in 2005. So that's a huge get. Kenta Kobashi is a big get for StarCast. But here's the deal. If Undertaker and Kurt Angle, who also supposedly signed a new contract, if Undertaker and Angle sign new contracts, and it's in their deals that they can't do things like this, or that WWE has to approve it, that really should not be retroactive to include contracts already signed with third parties for events like this. Conrad, he may have grounds to sue. I mean, I'm no lawyer, so I don't know for sure. He may well, if he feels he's got signed agreements, have the grounds to sue. But what's he going to do? He's going to spend money to sue WWE? Of course not. And why would he even try to burn that bridge? It's stupid. So there's nothing he can do, realistically. It makes The Undertaker look bad, too, if he agreed to these things and then signed a new deal, knowing what was in the contract, because it fucks these other people over who are dealing with him and his people in good faith. If I'm Conrad, you know what I'm doing? I said this on Twitter, and I was serious. I'm calling up Rod McMahon. Get him to come to StarCast. Yes, Vince has an older brother that we never hear about because he's not involved in the wrestling business, although he was going to make his television debut on the Raw show, where they were going to eulogize Vince. This was after the limo explosion, where Vince was quote-unquote killed. An angle, by the way, where when Vince blew up on television, and this is a true story, one of the first phone calls he got was from Donald Trump, who had either heard about or saw what happened and was legitimately, legitimately concerned. Wow. About Vince McMahon. That's a friend, I guess, right? That's certainly one way to put it. But when they did that angle, they were going to have this big funeral on TV for Vince the following week. And they had actually flown in his brother, Rod McMahon, to make an appearance on the show as a McMahon family member. And then the Benoit stuff happened that same day, and it got scrapped. We were this close to seeing Rod McMahon, and it was taken away from us. Now, I've seen pictures of Rod. The two of them don't look anything alike. But Court Bauer told the story years ago on his podcast, and I believe that was around the time he was writing for WWE. Rod was going to be brought in, and the plan was that he was going to basically be the polar opposite of Vince's character on TV. Whereas Vince was just this mean SOB and loud and obnoxious, Rod was going to be the nice McMahon. You know, he was going to be very quiet and very reserved, and everybody was going to like him. And it would lead ultimately to a family fight for control of the company. And none of this ever happened. Get him at StarCast. But I hope this doesn't mean the end of these Undertaker interviews that we've been seeing lately. He's done a couple of interviews with that pastor or minister, I forgot what his name was. And a couple of other ones too, just out of character as Mark Calloway. And it's fascinating to just listen to him speak like a normal human being and tell some of these stories. And I'd like to see him doing more of those things because it is fascinating to listen to him speak. And the stories that this guy could tell, if he got the right interviewer who could ask the right questions, I think could be a lot of fun. If they want to stop him from having other people interview him and save it for some, you know, for their own network, then fine. That kind of makes sense, right? Maybe they're just thinking, look, we want to be the ones to do the quote unquote first shoot interview with The Undertaker or sit him down live on the network and build a whole special out of it. But I don't hear any plans for them wanting to do that. I think this is Vince McMahon just wanting to protect the aura of the Undertaker character. You know, it's his greatest creation. The Undertaker is Vince McMahon's greatest creation. I mean, outside of, you know, WrestleMania and all that. It is his greatest creation, his greatest gimmick ever conceived. And in his mind, maybe he just wants to protect that. He hates the idea that other people are going to profit off of it and that he's going to go out there and you know, answer all these questions and do all these things and kind of expose himself in a way that he hasn't before. But it would really suck if the only reason for them to do this is to keep this guy under lock and key so we don't ever get to hear from him. I think it's totally a bad look for WWE. And it's not the only thing that made them look bad this week. Although they may be able to do these things legally, it doesn't mean that they come off well in the court of public opinion. Here's another example. According to The Observer, Luke Harper, who went public with the news that he had requested a release from his WWE contract, and in doing so posted a very complimentary note about his time there. His request reportedly has been denied. And not only has it been denied, they've tacked on another 6 months to his contract for the time he missed with his wrist surgery. So that would keep him locked up until right before next year's WrestleMania. And according to The Observer, he was slated to begin a program on TV with Sami Zayn. That would have gotten him back on TV. That would have gotten him back into the mix. And for whatever reason, the plan was dropped at the last minute. And I've been enjoying heel Sami Zayn and his kind of work shoot promos on TV. He seems to be having a lot of fun. So I like what they have chosen to do with Sami. Maybe it was Sami's idea. But I can understand why Luke Harper would be frustrated by that. And supposedly that was the main catalyst for him deciding to make the call that, hey, I think it's time that we part ways. That was really what kind of pushed him over the edge. He was ready to come back to TV. He's been away for so long. They had this idea for him. And then it was just dropped. It was just taken away. He and Rowan, they won the SmackDown Tag Team titles at last year's WrestleMania. They held them right on through SummerSlam. It was the very first SmackDown on TV that they dropped the titles after SummerSlam because at the pay-per-view, Rowan suffered a torn bicep. So they dropped the belts to New Day on SmackDown. That was his last match before undergoing wrist surgery, which he decided to go ahead and take care of, given that his partner was going to be out for a while with an injury of his own. So WWE is saying now, you signed a contract. It does not expire until November. We are not letting you go because you are out hurt. We're now going to extend you. It's the same thing they did to Rey Mysterio back in 2014. His deal was about to end, and they extended it. And eventually they released him. They came to some kind of agreement. And 10 months later, in 2015, they finally let him go, and he was a free man. I believe, and I am not signed to a WWE contract. If you listen to the show every week, that much should be obvious. But my understanding is that all of the talent contracts have a clause that allows them to freeze your deal or to extend your deal should you miss any significant time due to injury. And shout out to Matt McLean and the article that he wrote for the Voices of Wrestling website 3 years ago about Daniel Bryan and his whole contract situation when that was going on. In the article, he cited the language of the so-called freezing clause that was included in Stephanie McMahon's contract from 2013, which is in the public domain, and you can access it if you search hard enough for it. So if we are to assume that the contract language has not changed much, if at all, in the last 6 years, and that Luke Harper had the same language in his contract and isn't some kind of special case, this is what the clause in question states. I'm going to read the actual clause verbatim here. This is what it says. In the event that wrestler is unable to wrestle for 6 consecutive weeks during the term of this agreement for any or no reason, including, without limitation, due to an injury suffered while performing services at the promoter's discretion, promoter shall have the right to thereafter terminate this agreement, suspend wrestler either with or without pay, and or extend the term of this agreement for a period of time equal to the entire period of inability to wrestle or any portion thereof. Upon certification by wrestler or promoter's physician during any period of suspension, that wrestler is fully recovered and capable of performing all services as required under this agreement, the promoter shall have the right to reinstate this agreement, and it will thereafter continue to be of full force and effect throughout the remainder of the term. So what does that mean in plain English? It means that if you are a WWE performer and you are out for any reason for at least 6 weeks in a row, WWE can either terminate you outright, they can suspend you with or without pay, or they can extend your contract for the length of time in which you're out hurt. And what made the Bryan thing so complicated is that the language there is a little more vague when it comes to wrestlers who either decide to retire or who are physically just not able to be cleared by WWE doctors. That was the issue with Daniel Bryan. He tried to quit. They said no. He came back as the SmackDown GM instead because they wouldn't clear him to wrestle. He would have wrestled the next day if they would let him, and they wouldn't clear him. So they made him the GM on TV. But at least with him being on TV as the GM, they couldn't freeze his deal because he was working. He was performing. As long as he was working, he could just bide his time until his contract ran out, and then he could go wrestle somewhere else, unless they wanted to be dicks. And midway through his GM run, they decide to boot him off television. And in the end, he chose to resign. He had the right, he had the opportunity to go work the independent scene, make a lot of money, have a lot of fun, do whatever he wants, make his own schedule, not worry about doctors and being cleared and this and that. He opted to re-sign a new deal with WWE. But in this case, it would be pretty clear based on the language that WWE is well within its right, if it so chooses, to do exactly what it looks like they are doing with Luke Harper. All that being said, this is clearly being done to send a message to the other talent in the company who might possibly be thinking about doing the same thing. They are making an example out of Luke Harper. They are making an example out of this fucking guy. There is absolutely no question about it. Plain and simple. They get to pick and choose who they grant a release to and who they don't. And a lot of it has to do with your position on the card. Harper may not have been used in any meaningful role in a while, but at one time he was a solid upper mid-card performer in that company, and he was getting a good amount of TV time. I mean, shit, he was this close to getting a WWE Championship match at WrestleMania 2 years ago. And, you know, doing all the stuff he did with the Wyatt family and all the TV time at one time that they had. But they clearly do not apply the same rules in every case. They're very inconsistent in that way. Case in point, Ty Dillinger. Nobody is going to mistake Ty Dillinger for being a big name on the SmackDown roster. They barely used him, and when they did, it was usually to put other people over. He was not an important part of the show. Ty Dillinger had surgery for a hand injury in October of last year. It kept him on the shelf for months. He came back at a house show in February of this year. 10 days later, he did the exact same thing that Luke Harper did. Luke Harper was following his lead. He posted a very nice note on social media one night, I think it was right after SmackDown went off the air, letting the world know that he had just requested his release from WWE. 3 days later, his request was granted. And he was a free man. I don't know how much time was left on his contract. It's possible Harper has more time on his deal than Dillinger had on his. But that right there tells you that if they wanted to, they could have granted Harper his release, and they chose not to. That is their right. Hideo Itami, he's another one. He's another one who asked for and was granted his release earlier this year. But Harper? Nope. So what happens is it just makes them look like the evil empire, and it shows you that, yes, they're worried about losing him to their competition. They clearly see some value in this guy, just not enough to do anything of actual value on television with him, although maybe now they will. They should. If they plan to keep him around for another year, they should. Or at least, you know, just do something meaningful with him. Or they could just decide to job him out or sit him at home. They don't want him going somewhere else and becoming a bigger deal than he was on their own roster, because all that does is draw attention to their own failures. Their own creative failures. It's another reason why I am rooting for companies that you should be too. I don't care if they're called AEW, you know, or WEA or WBF. I don't give a shit. Whatever they're called, you should be rooting for all of these companies to flourish, because the more options that are out there where you can make good money, and who's to say, look, that a company like AEW won't include a similar type of clause in their own contracts? You know, maybe they turn out to be the evil empire too. Who knows? In due time, we'll find out. Supposedly, they're more wrestler friendly. Well, we'll see about that. That sounds great, right? Everybody says that. But let's put things into practice and see how wrestler friendly they really are. But to have another option, if you're a wrestler, an option where not only you can make good money, but there's good exposure, good television exposure, maybe guys won't be so quick to just sign with WWE just because of who they are. Or if WWE wanted somebody bad enough, maybe they feel, you know what, I feel like I've got enough juice to stand up and say, I want this in my contract, or I don't want that in my contract. You know, I'm no Alberto Del Rio fan, but I give the guy credit. When he came back to WWE, he had an opt-out clause put into his contract that gave him the power to give the company 90 days notice if he wanted to leave. That's a luxury that the company enjoys, not the talent. The company can terminate you any fucking time they want to, without any warning. Give you 90 days notice and boot you right out the door. They have that luxury. Del Rio said, no, I want the same luxury. Because WWE, they don't put that in talent contracts. They have all the power. But he had it put into his deal that he could. He could have that same power. He was the exception. Because he asked for it. He fought for it. Maybe it's time that some of these guys take some of that power out of WWE's hands and fights for more of it themselves. Real competition may allow for that to start to happen more often if the wrestlers start standing up for themselves. If that's what's important to them. You know, the independent contractor stuff is not going to change anytime soon. And just because you're classified as an independent contractor, that doesn't mean that you can't enter into an exclusive agreement with somebody, which is what he did here. So his options are limited. Unless he wants to run the risk of burning a bridge, that probably isn't wise for him to burn. But I think others could learn from this going forward. And speaking of guys who want out of WWE, Dean Malenko quit his position as a road agent this week. Joey Numbers of Wrestling Soup was actually the first person to post something about an agent quitting the company. And then hours later, we had Sports Illustrated claim the exclusive. But they did name who the agent was, and that is Dean Malenko. Malenko had been working for the company for the past 18 years. He debuted, of course, if you remember, as a part of the Radicals back in 2000 with Chris Benoit and Eddie Guerrero and Perry Saturn. Although technically, he made his WWE debut long before that, in the mid-1980s, as a referee. You can see him if you go back and watch the very first Saturday Night's Main Event that aired in 1986. So the first episode of the year, I don't know if it was just the Randy Savage-George Steele match or if it was more than just that one match on the show, but there you see a young Dean Malenko. He don't look much younger than he looked in WCW 10 years later. I kind of think that Dean Malenko popped out of his mother's womb looking like a 35-year-old CPA. And I could only imagine the look on her face when she looked down and saw that. But yeah, he was a referee down in the Florida area for a while. And I think that Saturday Night's Main Event was taped in the Florida area. So they used him. And I think he did a few WWF shows. And he was a referee. And I didn't even know that until this past week. So hey, you know, the more you know. But after he retired from the ring is when he started his gig as an agent behind the scenes. And PW Insider says that the word going around is that something happened backstage at SmackDown on Tuesday that upset him. No idea what that might be, but that may have been what caused him to quit because it took a lot of people by surprise. They did not see that one coming. And WWE, you know, WWE has also been bringing in a lot of new blood behind the scenes in similar roles. You know, creative roles, road agent positions. You know, Jeff Jarrett is working there now. Abyss, Shane Helms, Sanjay Dutt. Maybe he saw the writing on the wall. Maybe they're trying to edge some of these older guys out. I don't know. Doesn't sound like it. It sounds like he made the call here, not the company. But who knows how much that may have factored into it. But it didn't take long for Conrad to sign him. Signed him up for an appearance at StarCast. He's already being advertised. Maybe somebody will ask him what happened. Raw Monday night was live from Des Moines, Iowa. We had almost 2,500 votes in our Twitter poll. 37% thumbs up 63% thumbs down. This was a show that, according to Brian Alvarez, had its script finished a mere 4 minutes before they went on the air. Four more minutes, and they would have been rewriting the show while the show was in progress. They had an alarming crash and burn with the Raw ratings this week. 2.3 million overnight viewers, but that wasn't the story. The story was the drop of over 400,000 viewers from hour one to hour two, and more than 500,000 viewers in total from hour one to hour three that they basically bled out. Just 2.1 million viewers for that third hour. For a comparison, I went and looked it up. The same episode of Monday Night Raw last year, April 23rd, 2018, did 3.1 million overnight viewers. And that show was a drop of over 500,000 people from the week before that. So that 3.1 million was probably considered a bad number. Now it's 2.3 million. And that third hour from that show last year did 2.8 million viewers. That's a drop of 464,000 viewers from hour one to hour three. And that show, too, was up against the NBA playoffs. The game they were up against this week did under 3 million viewers. So you can't use that as an excuse to just explain away a bad number this week. But you look at those numbers and you see the continuing trend downward. And I joked on Twitter about that hour three plummet corresponding to Baron Corbin being in the main event. And I do think he is poison in the main event. As a heel, he's fine. And he gets heat in the buildings, but that shouldn't be in main events. That shouldn't, you know, he should be kept out of main events. But I was only half joking when I blamed him. You know, AJ Styles, well, the people have pointed out, well, AJ Styles was in that match too. You're right, he was. And guess who else wrestled in that third hour? Becky Lynch. And, you know, Becky Lynch is the woman who headlined this year's WrestleMania. This company does not have a Baron Corbin problem. This company has an overexposure problem. They have a creative problem. Not being able to keep people engaged with the show, no matter how good some of the matches might be. But it isn't just a Raw problem. WWE released its first quarter financial earnings this week. Revenue was down from the same period last year, but the things that really jumped out at me were, and I, you know, when it comes to the revenue being down as compared to last year, you know, things like that could have to do just with more spending. If they're spending more money on things, then yes, they're probably going to be down. I'm not even concerned about that. All the headlines about the revenue drop, and obviously the stock price reacted poorly to that. But I'm not even focused on that. What really jumped out at me were the 14% decline in Raw ratings from the year prior, 13% decline in SmackDown ratings, both of which the company attributes to talent absences. That's the reason, in their view, for the ratings declines. Basically, what they're saying is no Roman Reigns or John Cena. That's really what they mean. We get the big dog back, maybe a few other names, and those viewers are going to magically return. Talent absences. There's an absence of talent, all right. I'm not sure it's just in the ring, though. This company has more talent than ever before. More talent than they know what to do with. Look at poor Luke Harper. They've got guys under contract sitting in the back, sitting at home. They don't know what to do with half these people. They've got more talent than ever before. I don't know that it speaks well to their ability to create new stars when you're missing a couple of big ones and you cite talent absences as the reason for these massive ratings declines. I looked at the PDF on their corporate website where they list their key performance indicators. They included a color chart that shows the Raw and SmackDown declines in Q1 compared to the declines in the ratings for the top 25 cable networks in that same quarter. The top 25 cable networks combined in the first quarter were down 5% from last year. Raw and SmackDown were down 14% and 13% respectively. So TV may have been down, but WWE was down a lot more. And that top 25 average may well have been skewed a little bit by Raw and SmackDown being so low, considering that WWE is still among the top rated shows on cable every single week. They don't have a stranglehold on the number one spot or the number two spot like they used to, but they are still in the top mix. So that 5% may have been a little lower had WWE not been down by so much. But here's another scary number. So that's scary enough. And you'll still have the, you know, the brigade of people, ratings don't matter, of course, we know that's bullshit. And yes, TV habits have changed, and there's Hulu, and there's this, and there's that. You could argue that they don't matter in exactly the same way they did in 1997, but to make the argument that ratings don't matter, it's not a big deal, you're a moron. And you're ignoring the facts. But here's another scary number. Average attendance for their live events in North America, down 11% from the same period a year before. So not only are fewer people watching their shows, fewer people are turning out for the live events. And yes, they'll have that Fox money coming in starting in the fall. But it should be a big concern that fewer people are paying to go to your shows. And talent absences is far from the only reason for all of those numbers. That's a cute excuse. And it can be a pain in the ass when guys go down with an injury and, you know, TV storylines have to be rewritten and plans have to change, but to blame all of it on talent absences. Well, we had 15 people out at different points with injuries, says Vince McMahon. Really? Okay, well, Fandango, I think being off TV is not going to really bring the Raw rating down too much, but please do tell me more. Before the show on Monday, WWE sent Andrade Cien Almas and Zelina Vega back to SmackDown Live, along with Aleister Black. According to PW Insider, the reason for the Andrade switch was because Fox wants Latino stars on the show, and maybe that was part of it. But the Observer made it very clear that this was done to put Andrade back on the same brand with his girlfriend, Charlotte Flair, which I think is what everybody assumed the reason to be when they first heard about this, because they moved them to Raw. They make their Raw debut, all of a sudden they get moved back. Doesn't take a huge leap in logic to figure out why that may have happened. But because of that, because of the Charlotte stuff, that meant that Zelina had to go back because she's the manager for Andrade and they should not be broken up. They're a great package duo on TV. So if Andrade moves, Zelina has to move. Well, if Zelina moves, she's married to Aleister Black. That meant that he too had to go to SmackDown, which broke up his team with Ricochet. Now, I think that's a good thing and one that should have been done anyway, but boy, that's a big disruption to have to make for one person. She really is the queen. Meanwhile, with Sheamus out due to an injury, it might be a concussion, that's what I've heard, Cesaro was moved over to Monday Night Raw, which could spell the end of the bar, unless they just put Sheamus on Raw when he's all healed up. As expected, Samoa Joe and the U.S. title are now a part of Monday Night Raw. I think this is a net positive for SmackDown, and actually, I think it tilts things the other way. I thought Raw got the better of the shakeup last week when I talked about it, but I might give the edge to SmackDown now. And splitting up Black and Ricochet to let them have singles runs, I think, is a good thing. But this was a show on Monday night. You know, I mentioned before, 37% thumbs up that you guys gave this show? This was a show where we got Seth Rollins versus AJ Styles set up for the Money in the Bank pay-per-view, where the Viking experience is no more. They changed their name. I'll talk about that in a second. Bobby Roode is finally a heel again, which I've been saying for years. I don't know why it took this long, but that's a good move. And Bray Wyatt re-emerged, re-debuted as a creepy Pee Wee Herman. Well, I mean, Pee Wee was a creepy guy. Creepy Pee Wee is, I guess, a bit redundant. But I enjoyed this, and yet, from all these good things I just mentioned, with all those positives that I just listed, I was still bored for a lot of this show. Maybe it's the pacing in all of the commercials. I know they have an extra hour to fill now, one more than they did 20 years ago, but even SmackDown at 2 hours, I mean, is it me? Or are there just a ton of more commercial breaks on these shows? Like, right in the middle of matches, too. It's not just the fact they have commercials, but that's understandable. But the way they put them and place them, it's... I think the format, honestly, has a lot to do with it. I really do. The formula of this show sucks. They need to shake up the show, not just the roster. Right down to the way they shoot the matches and the entrances, the backstage interviews, when and how they cut to commercial. All of that matters when you've been doing it the same way for 20 years. There's just the sameness about it that I don't care if you shake up the roster twice a year, the show still looks and feels the same. But we had this opening segment, this cringy opening segment with Seth Rollins and Triple H in the ring telling Rollins about, you know, the triple threat matches that were going to be taking place on the show tonight, and the winners of the two triple threats would meet, and that person would challenge Seth for the championship at Money in the Bank. They're interrupted by this endless parade of the men coming out to stake their claim on wanting a crack at the tomato title. We had Samoa Joe and Rey Mysterio come out, then Drew McIntyre came out, then The Miz came out, then Baron Corbin came out, then AJ Styles came out. And Seth Rollins ends the segment by talking about how at Money in the Bank, I'm gonna burn it down. The fuck does that even mean? I wish he would burn this show down. This was so lame. I hate segments like this. They are a waste of time, which of course is what they want, because they have 3 hours to fill. I mean, they would do segments like this, meaning long 15, 20 minute talking segments, even on Raw in the Attitude Era. But there's some big differences there. Number one, first of all, those segments, for the most part, were entertaining. But number two, they were still kept more limited than they are now because they only had 2 hours, right? So you had to move on to the next thing. You know, and a lot of those segments went too long also. Trust me, they weren't all entertaining. But because of the two-hour format, they were just naturally limited by how long they could have these guys out there for because they had to move on to the next segment. And back then, you know, everybody had something going on. Didn't matter if you were low on the card, if you were a mid-card guy, everybody had some kind of a gimmick or a storyline going on and they had to get to it. But I absolutely just despise these segments that are just meant to fill time. That's the problem, ultimately, with this format. You don't feel like you're watching a show that's really advancing anything. You're just trying to kill time. It's like they're in the back looking at their watch. All right, we got some more time to kill here. We had two triple threat matches out of it, though. Great finish, I thought, to the AJ Styles, Samoa Joe, Rey Mysterio match. We had AJ powerbombing Rey on top of Joe, and then hitting a Styles clash to Rey on top of Samoa Joe. So AJ Styles wins, and he advances. We had Baron Corbin stealing a win from Drew McIntyre after a Claymore kick to The Miz. McIntyre seemingly had the match won until Corbin shoved Drew out of the ring and stole the pin. So that brought us to a singles main event of AJ Styles against Baron Corbin that was later in the show. We had Naomi. She beat Billie Kay with a sunset flip roll-up in about a minute. Another Iconics loss, this time in singles competition. I think we're actually regressing with the women and the length of these matches. Does it feel that way since WrestleMania? I think we're actually going backwards instead of forwards. We had Sami Zayn come out. He cut another fun promo I said earlier when I was talking about the Luke Harper stuff. Sucks for Luke Harper if there were plans for something with him and Sami, but I love what Sami's been doing. He comes out, talks about how happy he's been, and all the months away were some of the best months of his life, and he's showing us a slideshow of all the different places in the world that he visited, from Norway to Mexico. He was visiting, you know, the orphanage or whatever with El Generico to make sure that he was okay. All these places, Scotland, all these places that he was visiting, and he was so happy to be there and out of this toxic environment, this toxic wrestling environment. And of course, he ended by saying, all you people can take a trip as well. You can all go to hell. He seemed very happy with himself when this was over. So I don't know where this is leading or who his first program is going to be with, but I'm enjoying what they're doing with Sami Zayn so far. He seems to be too. Cesaro, the newest member of the Raw roster, against another new member of the Raw roster, Cedric Alexander. Good match, but the problem is when you put two new roster members against each other, one has to win and one has to lose. And in this case, the loser was Cedric Alexander. He hit a Michinoku driver on Cesaro for a near fall, toe payout to the floor, springboard. Well, I guess the attempt anyway at a springboard lands him in the path of an uppercut, and Cesaro picks up the win. So, look, you know, would I have had Cedric lose on TV this week? Probably not, but he was going to have to lose at some point. If he goes out there and has matches like this, working people like Cesaro every week, I think he'll be okay. I don't get the impression they have any big plans for Cedric. The Viking Experience lasted all of 1 week. They are now the Viking Raiders. The fans were able to shame them into a new name. Even WWE realized that the name was shit.
But I thought Road Dogg said names don't matter.
So that's the good news. They actually listened, and they changed the name. The bad news is, their new name is not much better. And they're still Eric and Ivar, but you know what? I'll take it. Still beats the hell out of the Viking experience. Although they didn't totally abandon that name, that's now the name of their finish. It's no longer Thor's Hammer, because that actually sounded cool. We can't have that. Not on the main roster. You notice how the main roster takes cool things from either outside the company or from NXT, and they immediately make it uncool? Well, that's what they did here with their finish. Their finish is no longer Thor's Hammer. It is now the Viking experience. Whatever. The War Raiders become the Viking experience. Then the Viking Raiders. Bobby Roode is now Robert Roode. Mustafa Ali is just Ali. Andrade Cien Almas is just Andrade. No wonder nobody can get over anymore. We don't know what to fucking call them. What other NFL teams can they squeeze into their new name? We have the Vikings. We have the Raiders. Titans? That would be natural. The Viking Raider Titans? They laid waste to the Lucha House Party before their match could even begin. I see that WWE did another fan council survey. I saw the survey. They were listed in the survey as the Viking Warriors, and I know some websites are running with that, claiming, oh, did they get their name changed again? I think it was just a typo. They still have the Viking Raiders name on WWE.com, and they're usually pretty quick to make any changes like that on the website, so until I hear otherwise, I believe they are still the Viking Raiders. I don't believe their name has changed again. Speaking of Vince's fetish for weird things, I saw that the word belt is apparently no longer banned on WWE television. Ever since Becky Lynch started calling herself Becky Two Belts, now it's okay to use the word belt again. After how many years? It's okay to use the word belt again. Now I'm going to be watching every week, waiting to spot these belt references to see if it's true. Speaking of, Becky Lynch came out for a promo with both belts. Lacey Evans interrupted and said that she would take both titles from Becky, which as we now know is not true. She had a match with the returning Alicia Fox that was not very good. In fact, this was really bad. Corey Graves made a comment about how Alicia looked healthy. Not sure if that's a reference to rehab or not, but otherwise I'm not sure what the hell that would even mean. It's a very odd thing for him to say on TV. At one point, Alicia almost killed Becky. She was doing her tilt-a-whirl. She does this tilt-a-whirl into a backbreaker, which normally when Alicia hits this, it looks pretty devastating. In this case, though, she botched it somehow. It got botched, whoever botched it, and she almost tombstoned Becky Lynch, nearly dropped her right on her frickin' head. That was ugly. So this match was just, it was no good. And Becky, you know, I love her, I do, but watch her run the ropes. It's like she's got a 20-pound anchor tied to her ass. What is with that? She's like running in slow motion. She won with the disarmer. As soon as she did, before she could even let go of the hold, Lacey Evans nailed her with her woman's right. The big right hand to the face. Or did she? It looked like it barely grazed her. This was horrible. This was horrible. And what's worse is that Becky sold it like death. It missed by a mile, at least from that camera angle, and Becky sold it like death. Holy cow, was this bad. And I think they realized that, I bet you, here's what I think happened. I bet you they called an audible, and they had her redo it, because once Becky got back up, Lacey hit her again. This time, at least, the punch looked like it connected. So I wouldn't be at all shocked if the referee got a little call in his ear saying, hey, tell her to do it over again. But my God, this was bad. Tom Selleck beat Ricochet. Actually, it's Robert Roode now. He's no longer Bobby Roode. He did the Robert Roode thing for a while in TNA, too, when he was a heel. But now Roode is rocking a porn star mustache, channeling ravishing Rick Roode, even though he looks more like Silas Young. If Conan O'Brien did his old If They Made It sketch and fused Rick Roode and Silas Young together, it would look exactly like Bobby Roode does now. But Ricochet comes out. What a fail this is. So I've talked about how they added little sound effects to their entrances. Aleister Black has the creaking sound like he's fucking Dracula rising from his coffin. With Ricochet, Vince McMahon decided, you know what this entrance needs? The lasers aren't enough. Oh no, we don't need lasers. We need little Ricochet noises like you would see on Bugs Bunny. or in an old Western. Well, they added more. They added more ricochet sounds to this guy's entrance. All I can think of is Elmer Fudd when I see him now. Ricochet's entrance was cool. He had the lasers, the smoke, cool music. Everything about it said, this is pretty cool. And then he comes to the main roster, and they add fucking Bugs Bunny noises to his entrance. Pew pew, pew pew. What did I just say? What did I just say about the main roster immediately taking something that's cool and making it uncool? They did a lot of that this week. And I have never seen a crowd this quiet for a Ricochet match. It was scary. And then he lost. But it looks like they may be pushing Bobby Roode and doing so as a heel. He has been totally miscast as a babyface from the moment he debuted on SmackDown. Maybe now they can get something going with him. Because in NXT, he was entertaining. He was entertaining enough. I believe he can be again. This was also Ricochet's first singles loss on the main roster. But I don't think it's a big deal. It's one match. If it becomes a pattern, that's a different story. The mystery of the creepy buzzard puppet vignettes has been revealed. And they were indeed connected to the return of Bray Wyatt. But I doubt anybody saw his return taking the form that it did on Monday night. We got a vignette for a children's-style show hosted by Bray called Bray's Firefly Funhouse. With a catchy little jingle and little kids graphics. And he looks great. Bray himself looks great. He was all dressed up looking like he raided Mr. Rogers' wardrobe. This was the real-time reaction. Let me play this here. From Seth Rollins and Cesaro, backstage, as they were being interviewed, when the Bray Wyatt vignette suddenly came up. This was their instant reaction.
But anyway, it was funny how everybody just...
Holy what in all hell is happening right now? I'm sorry. What is happening? Oh, that's weird. That's not what I was expecting at all.
No, me neither.
Weird little vignettes. This makes me happy.
That pretty much sums up my reaction after watching this also. Bray introduced us to his new puppet friends, Mercy the Buzzard, which I'm sure is a nod to Waylon Mercy, which is awesome. And the other puppet we've seen in those creepy vignettes, Penny the Witch. At least it sounded like she said Penny. Bray was using the hashtag Abby the Witch on Twitter, which would be a nod to Sister Abigail, but I'm pretty sure on TV she said Penny. He said that he had been barbarically punished for his wrongdoings. I'd like to think that the barbaric punishment is a reference to his awful booking. He had a cardboard cutout of his old self as a reminder that he never again turns into that slob loser. He had two gloves on, one with the word hurt on it, the other with the word heel. When he held the one with the word hurt up to his ear, it sounded like it was talking to him. And he then took a chainsaw to the cardboard stand-up. Bray's character was so badly damaged and stale that he needed a reset. And this could be just the answer. Something that is so bizarre, you just cannot take your eyes off of it. Something that creeps you out. Not like Vince McMahon wanting to do a storyline where he impregnated his daughter, and then when his daughter rejected that idea, have her brother be the father of her child. Not that level of creepy. That's a different kind of creepy. But creepy in a way that keeps the viewer engaged and wanting more, which is what I felt when this was over. I didn't actually quite know what to think when this was over. Part of me wanted to hate it, but I couldn't. Because I saw it the way that a lot of people probably saw it at first. This is it. This is the death of Bray Wyatt. Look what they have this guy doing. But then I watched it again, and I thought more about it, and I watched it again, and it's the most interested I've been in maybe anything on this television show, let alone Bray Wyatt, in a very long time. And actually, when I watched it a few more times, I got this vibe. It reminded me of the Candle Cove season of Channel Zero. Channel Zero was a sci-fi network series that got canceled, which is a travesty. There were four seasons. Each one was based on a different creepypasta. Creepypastas are basically online horror stories that people create. And that first season was based on the creepypasta called Candle Cove, which is about a children's television show that only a few people are able to see when they're kids. It would come on randomly while they would be watching TV. And I don't want to give it all away, but it's disturbing. That's what this reminded me of, Candle Cove with the puppets. SEScoops.com had a whole post with an interesting theory behind the Bray Wyatt stuff. Bray deleted a bunch of tweets last year that he posted during his time off that would lead you to believe that his character had been institutionalized for some sort of mental illness. And one of his last tweets said this: "I have so many things to fix. I realized that I was sick. My mind doesn't work like other people's. It gets lost and attached to ideals that are unrealistic and poisonous. My next journey will be to find my true calling." This new persona may well be that true calling that he was talking about in those tweets before he deleted them. See, I love shit like this, where there's like a thread and you follow along, like the viral marketing campaign that for that first Cloverfield movie. It went nowhere. Actually, the viral marketing was probably more interested than any of the stories in the actual movie, although I love the movie. But it was at least fun to follow along. I love stuff like that. And hey, you know, who knows where this could go? Maybe each time he beats somebody, they could end up as a character in his funhouse, like a soul trapped in purgatory. Sounds like the perfect role for Luke Harper. Art imitates life. I can't wait for him to also add a boss puppet named Sasha. They could have a whole little playhouse thing going on. I said this to somebody on Twitter, and I meant this. I think this is a good way to look at it. If Doink the Clown had debuted today, instead of when he did in 1993, actually end of 92, beginning of 1993, if Vince McMahon had taken a great wrestler in Matt Bourne and dressed him up like a clown on TV today, the outrage on social media would be like something we have never seen before. If Waylon Mercy debuted on television today instead of when he did in 1995, people would be saying, "What have they done to Danny Spivey?" And I happen to think that character was ahead of its time. If they had waited another year or two, and if Spivey wasn't so broken down physically, he would have been much bigger than he was. But today, people wouldn't have given either one of those characters a chance. Heel Doink was fantastic. Babyface Doink sucked. Heel Doink was fantastic. Waylon Mercy had great potential. Bray even based a lot of his own character and the look of his character when he first debuted around Waylon Mercy. He even named, again, the buzzard here in his skit, he looks like he named after him. So the point is, let's give this a chance. Let's not abandon all hope before we've had a chance to see how this evolves and where this goes. People crapped on the New Day too when those first vignettes aired. But it got over, and they're still at it 5 years later. Bray physically looks to be in the best shape of his career. It's the best shape I've ever seen him in. Going all the way back to his Husky Harris days in NXT, he looks to be in fantastic shape. He was badly in need of a new look and a new direction. The days of people thinking that this guy's going to be the next Undertaker are long gone. There were people who thought that character had potential. And that potential died. You know, when he lost to John Cena at WrestleMania 30, it died. When he lost to The Undertaker at WrestleMania 31, it was still dead. You know, any even inclination or thought of that should have been abandoned long ago. That just was not going to happen. I don't think a character like that could work in today's WWE. I don't think you can ever again have another Undertaker, whatever that means, in WWE, just based on the way that they do things and the way that they do television. It's not possible. It's not possible. Everybody has to lose. Even Steven. Overexposed. If the Undertaker character, if they tried it now, it would be no different. The Undertaker never would have been as big as he ended up being. It's not possible. As far as these rumors that WWE may have already gotten heat from some of their sponsors or stockholders about the angle, that they don't like the idea of a creepy cult leader character for kids. Bray even played off the rumor by tweeting out, "I love stockholders." They need to stay the course with this gimmick and let it play out. They cannot bow to pressure every time they try something new and creative because somebody doesn't like it. For each one who didn't like it, there may have been two more or three more who did. Stay the course with this. Do not water it down. Do not kill it. You could have something fun here. AJ Styles against Baron Corbin for the right to go to Money in the Bank against Seth Rollins. Corbin hit a deep six for a near fall. Clothesline went for the end of days. AJ rolled into the calf crusher. And Corbin countered. He was slamming AJ's head into the mat, Brock Lesnar style, from their match at Survivor Series a few years ago. Styles ended up hitting the phenomenal forearm and getting the pin, and I thought for sure he'd be screwed over somehow, and they would save this match for maybe a SummerSlam or some pay-per-view later on. But nope, AJ picked up the clean win, and AJ Styles wins the right to challenge Seth Rollins for the Tomato title at Money in the Bank. I am surprised they are going with this match so soon and not waiting for a big pay-per-view like SummerSlam. But that would mean matches in the interim with guys like Bobby Lashley and Baron Corbin, which we might still be getting this summer if the advertising for Extreme Rules is accurate. So, you know what? Hey, I'm happy. We're going to get this match. It's going to be a hell of a match. Their first ever meeting in a WWE ring. Rollins on Twitter said that he's been ready for this for 15 years. The one and only time I believe they were in the ring together in a singles match was at an NWA show in 2006. That's it. That's the only record I could find. 13 years ago. Now, there's going to be some wicked high expectations for this match, and I worry that we may be setting ourselves up for another Styles Nakamura from WrestleMania last year, where everybody, myself included, you kind of psych yourself up so much that you do a little bit too much psyching up. And you have these unrealistic expectations of what you're going to get. And when the match is over, you're kind of like, oh, well, it was all right. You know, I was kind of expecting more. It was kind of disappointing. Here's my suggestion. Just do what I do. I follow this philosophy in life, and it works for me. Lower your expectations and expect the worst. That way, you will rarely, if ever, be disappointed. Although somehow WWE finds a way to disappoint me time and again, so it doesn't always work. But temper your expectations. Both men, remember, they're also coming off injuries. Rollins had a back injury. AJ's coming out of his match with Randy Orton at WrestleMania. He had just recovered from a minor injury. So who knows how that might hinder things as well. But these two together have the potential to blow people away. And I expect greatness from them at Money in the Bank. Tomorrow night, Alexa Bliss hosts a Moment of Bliss. She will announce the Raw participants in the men's and... Well, she'll announce the participants in the men's and women's Money in the Bank ladder matches. Last year, it was Braun Strowman and Alexa. They were the winners. My early picks for the men's Money in the Bank were Drew McIntyre or Andrade Cien Almas, with Zelina Vega, you know, holding the briefcase for him every week when he comes out. Well, a local ad may have spoiled the names of the men's participants if you want to know what they are. If not, skip ahead 60 seconds. But the graphic in the ad shows both McIntyre and Andrade, as well as Aleister Black, Rey Mysterio, Ricochet, and Lars Sullivan. That would make 7 participants if this is legit, which is a crooked number, but when Sheamus won Money in the Bank a few years ago, that match also had 7 guys. So it's possible. They've had Money in the Banks with 7 people before, some with 6, some with 8. To me, it has to be McIntyre or Almas. And I've got Mandy Rose pegged for the women, as far as who I think is going to win. I feel like they're just dying to give her this big push, but they've kind of reached their quota at the moment of hot blondes. But if they want one winner from Raw and one winner from SmackDown, and I'm like I said, my early pick, I'm not doing my full predictions yet, but my early pick would be Mandy, who's on SmackDown. That would mean a Raw winner on the men's side. I think it favors Drew. You know, and I, again, my mind might change. We have a few more weeks of TV before we even get to Money in the Bank. We'll see, but on the men's side, I would have to think that Drew or Andrade would have to be a lock for that. Fightful.com broke the news about Lio Rush having major heat in the WWE locker room to the point where he would be lucky to keep his spot on the main roster. Rush was mocking these reports afterwards on social media, but he didn't outright deny anything. which is always something to pay attention to. Do you get a denial? Do you not get... I mean, that doesn't always mean anything. But sometimes these guys will go on social media and they'll talk about, oh, the dirt sheets and what do they know, but they won't actually come out and say that it's false. It's bad enough that the other wrestlers supposedly want him out of the locker room. It stems in part from him having his wife around almost at all times. That and an incident that apparently happened a while back involving Finn Balor, who was trying to impart some helpful advice on him about Vince McMahon likely not taking too kindly to his wife, for example, sitting in on rehearsals. And Leo responded to Finn in a way that was described as, not being overly respectful. And it rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. And Finn Balor comes across as the most laid-back, likable, nice guy on the entire roster. And to mouth off to him or get on his bad side, if that's what happened here, that says a lot. That really says a lot. This would not be the first time he's had heat with other wrestlers, going back to his ill-timed joke tweet about Emma after he, or she rather, not he, after she was released from the company. You know, Leo Rush, he's a young guy. He's very confident, obviously, in himself. He's very talented. I think he's an incredible talent, but pissing off the locker room is not going to be good for his future in that company. And if this is true, and you're Bobby Lashley, you want nothing to do with this guy, lest any of that heat rub off on you. You want to stay as far away from him as possible. So that's going to be an interesting situation to monitor. SmackDown Live from Lincoln, Nebraska, almost 2,000 votes in our Twitter poll. 65% thumbs up, 35% thumbs down. We had an opening segment with Shane McMahon calling out Roman Reigns for punching his father in the face. Elias came out for the distraction. They beat down Roman Reigns. They hightailed it out of there together, did Shane and Elias. It'll be Roman Reigns against Elias at Money in the Bank. A match that probably does more to, I don't want to say hurt Roman, but it just puts him in a match that it feels like is beneath him, as opposed to elevating Elias. I mean, Roman Reigns against Elias is it's a match. It's a TV match. It's not a pay-per-view match. But they're going to try to make a pay-per-view match out of it at Money in the Bank. And it looks like we are indeed getting a form anyway of Roman Reigns against the Authority. You know, he's going to be feuding for now with Shane McMahon. And believe you me, the reason they're doing Reigns and Elias when they are first here at Money in the Bank is because Reigns and Elias is just a means to an end. Reigns and Elias is merely the setup to Roman Reigns against Shane McMahon, which you know is coming. We had Finn Balor and Andrade Cien Almas. This time it was Balor getting his win back from their Raw match the previous week. They had another good match. This one ended with a botched assist from Zelina Vega, top rope crossbody that Balor dodged. Almas caught her, set her down gently, but then he got caught with a shotgun dropkick and the coup de grace for the win. They're now one win apiece, which I'm guessing means match number three for the Intercontinental title is coming up soon. I was going to say Money in the Bank, but you know, then I saw the spoiler ad, and I was, and still am really hoping. I mean, if it were me, I'd give him the Money in the Bank win. I mean, of those two matches, I think it would be better for him to be in the Money in the Bank match and win. He can always challenge Finn maybe this week. Maybe they'll do the championship match on TV this week. But I'm sure that is where we are headed. We had another Iconics singles match and another Iconics singles loss. This time it was Peyton Royce falling to Kairi Sane in her insane elbow. You know that Sasha is sitting at home, if she's even watching this. She's throwing furniture at home, watching all of these Iconics losses since they won those tag team titles. They so wanted to make those tag team titles mean something, and she's got to sit at home and watch this every single week. After the match, Mandy and Sonya walked out on stage to stare down Paige, Asuka, and Kairi. We got an Aleister Black vignette backstage. We don't know who he really is, and he cannot even begin to explain the complexity of my tragic caricature, he said. But as all good things, give it time. As all good things, give it time. These are wrestling fans. Give it time. They clearly don't know their own audience if they believe that. He said, give it time, and I'm sure the world you grew up in will have me condemned. This is called character development. which is different than the usual character assassination that we see on these shows. But this is character development, and it could be really good, or it could be very bad. I'll say good. I think they see big things in Alistair. I think he could be a top two or three guy on the brand before the year is out. So we'll see where this goes. Jinder Mahal and the Singh brothers are now on SmackDown Live. Oh, joy. So is the B-Team. Joy, joy. Jinder's match with Chad Gable never got started after he was attacked from behind by Lars Sullivan. On his way to the ring, Lars laid out both the Singh brothers. He laid out R-Truth. R-Truth came out to try to extract some revenge on Lars, and he ended up getting laid out. Got put down with the running Liger Bomb. The slow build for Lars, like they did with Lesnar all those years ago, it kind of reminds me of that. You know, when you watch the height that he got on that freak accident to one of the Singh brothers, it shows you that it's the smaller guys, I think, who are the ones who can really bump around for this guy and take those big moves and make him look like a real monster. You can't put him in the ring right away with big guys. It just, you're doing him a disservice by doing that. So having him come out and lay waste to the Singh brothers, having him come out and lay waste, you know, and I hate to say it, but a guy like Ali, Mustafa Ali, who I like a lot, but Mustafa Ali is the kind of guy who could probably make for a good opponent for Lars. And it's not going to be a win for Ali. But, you know, he's not the one they're building up right now. They're building up Lars. And so I think the more people he gets in the ring that he can bounce around like a freaking bouncy ball, it's going to make him look even more impressive and make him look more like a killer when he comes out. Charlotte was out for a face-to-face with Becky Lynch. Charlotte pointed out that she was never pinned, nor did she tap out at WrestleMania. She says that she is next in line after Becky wrestles Lacey Evans at Money in the Bank. Becky says that she wants new opponents like Mickey James and Bayley and Ember Moon. And that brought out Bayley. I guess Ember was passed out from a food coma in catering because she didn't come out. But Bayley came out and she had a bit of an edge to her this week, a welcome change for a character that desperately needs it. She challenged Charlotte to a match to see who would face Becky, and she smacked the microphone out of Charlotte's hand. So we got Charlotte against Bayley. Good match. There was a Charlotte No Belts chant, which I chuckled at. Not only is she Charlotte No Belts right now, although I bet that changes at Money in the Bank. In fact, I would count on it. It's worth noting that for all the shit that this woman gets, Charlotte has not won a pay-per-view match since SummerSlam. They have Rybacked her, which sounds lewd, but that's not what I mean. She has not won a pay-per-view match since SummerSlam, unless you want to count her DQ win over Becky at that Australia, the Super Showdown Down Under event they did last year. But really, SummerSlam is the last big show where Charlotte won anything important. After 10 minutes, Charlotte picked up the win with a spear. Becky says that she will defend both her championships at Money in the Bank, the Raw title against Lacey Evans, and the SmackDown Women's title against Charlotte Flair. So she's wrestling Charlotte and the 50% fewer calorie version of Charlotte at the pay-per-view. Diet Charlotte. Splitting the titles is something that I've seen some people talking about. Are they going to split the titles at Money in the Bank and not waste any more time? Or, you know, should they keep the belts, both belts on her for longer and keep the whole Becky two belts thing going for a while? I like the Shayna Baszler idea that I pitched last week on the podcast, which would have to keep both belts on Becky for at least a few more months. But, you know, for that idea, they'd have to get all the way to SummerSlam. SummerSlam's a long way away. So if they split the belts at Money in the Bank, which I think they are going to, I'm fine with that. Charlotte gets the SmackDown title back, which I feel like is inevitable. She can defend it on that show. Becky stays exclusive to Monday Night Raw. I was going to say Becky keeps the Raw title, but you know what? I don't think it's a lock that Becky Lynch is walking out with any championships at Money in the Bank. Because now here's the thing. So to get Charlotte on SmackDown with that belt is fine. And I think it makes sense. These two need to be split up and be kept apart for a while. And if that's what it takes to do it, then so be it. I don't want to say that Becky is fizzling right now. She's still very popular. Apparently, she's still selling a lot of merch and all that, and good for her. But there's definitely a spark missing now that Ronda Rousey is out of the picture. You know, it was a lot of fun to watch the back and forth between her and Ronda, and they were really going at it, a lot of it on social media, some of it on TV. And it was almost like Batman and Joker. It's like one, you can't have one with the other. Joker didn't want to kill Batman because he can't survive without him. And it's kind of the same thing with Becky and Rhonda. Now that Rhonda is gone, it's becoming very obvious that it's kind of tough to keep things interesting when it comes to who they have Becky feuding with. Becky and Lacey, it's not all Becky's fault, but, you know, is that really exciting anyone? Is another Becky-Charlotte feud and match really overly exciting to anybody? No. So I wouldn't sit here and say the woman is dying a death, but there's definitely something missing since WrestleMania. Maybe taking both championships off of her and making her chase for it all over again, they feel, is the way to go. I still say that Becky ends up with the Raw belt, Charlotte with the SmackDown belt. I don't know that Lacey is the one in her first big match to win the championship. She ain't that good. I mean, she's good, but she ain't that good. But I would not discount the possibility that Becky walks out beltless. That she walks out of that pay-per-view naked and beltless at Money in the Bank. Kofi Kingston against Shinsuke Nakamura. Rusev and Lana, Xavier Woods and Kevin Owens were all ringside for this. Kofi's first singles match since winning the championship at WrestleMania. He had Nakamura beat with the SOS when Rusev ran in for the DQ. Woods and Owens made the save. Owens launched Xavier out of the ring and onto Rusev out on the floor. But when he did so, Nakamura caught him with a Kinshasa. Inside the ring, Nakamura came in, tried to attack. Kofi shoved Owens out of harm's way, hit the Trouble in Paradise, and then when he got up, Owens, paying him back for that great deed that he had just performed, gave Kofi a super kick. Yes, no more pancakes, no more unicorn horn. Owens beat the hell out of him. Kofi fought back, but he got beaten down some more. He went to give him an apron powerbomb. Xavier stopped him, but he took the powerbomb on the apron instead. All is right with the world. Kevin Owens is once again a heel. Or was he ever not a heel? He was like Hogan, a heel, masquerading as a babyface. I love it. I love the turn. Although I was thinking, you know, it would have been even better if last week, when Kevin Owens gave Kingston the assist on his catapult dive out to the floor, instead of propelling Kofi out of the ring, if he would have caught Kofi in midair and turned it into a pop-up powerbomb. Or if they wanted to wait a week and not do it the first week, they could have done that this week too. That would have been a cool way to do the turn. This wasn't the Festival of Friendship or anything like that, but this had to be done. And now it sets up Kevin Owens as the first challenger for Kofi's championship, and I think that there is a good chance that Kevin Owens is going to take the title from him. I don't think it's a foregone conclusion that Kofi is going to hold it until, you know, SummerSlam or something like that. His run could end in a few weeks, and I'm okay with that, and then having him chase to try to get the belt back, even if he never does. But don't forget, we've got the return of Big E soon. It could be a month. It could be 6 weeks. I don't expect him to be out too long. Big E is going to come back. He's already gone off on Kevin Owens on social media. He's going to be looking for Kevin Owens when he comes back. We get to see maybe a more serious side of Big E. Maybe Big E challenges Owens for the championship. To me, the appeal with Kofi was in the chase and making history at WrestleMania. He did that. Anything else is gravy the way I look at it, whether they take the title from him at Money in the Bank or they take the title from him at SummerSlam. Doesn't matter to me. As long as they tell a good story with it, I don't care how long he holds the belt for. Originally, it was going to be Daniel Bryan getting a rematch with Kofi at Money in the Bank, but he's out hurt. That's the belief. We have not heard officially from WWE that Bryan is injured. Maybe they're working everybody and Bryan's just taking a few weeks off. He is listed, I think, for SmackDown this week in the live advertising. They have a European tour coming up. He's still listed as being part of the tour. Maybe Bryan will be back on TV this week. I don't know. But he's been out, and with that change in plans, after WrestleMania, they made the call to go with Owens as the next heel challenger instead of him being one of the top babyfaces on Raw with Roman Reigns, which apparently was the plan. He would be like a number two on the brand. Which is why they gave him the stunner. You know, he started using the stunner as a new finish. That's a babyface move. Now that he turned, I don't know. We'll see if they allow him to continue to use the stunner as a finish. The Hardy Boys have been MIA since beating the Usos to win the SmackDown Tag Team titles, and their reign may be short-lived. If this turns out to be true, Jeff Hardy was injured at the live event in Madison, Wisconsin last weekend, said to be a right knee injury. The nature of the injury is being kept quiet, but the Observer had a note that the belief among those who would need to know these things for storyline purposes is that he's having surgery sometime this week. So we'll see if they shoot some kind of angle on TV this Tuesday to get the belts off of them, or if maybe the injury isn't too severe, you know, they can just have them sit out for a while. You know, we'll see. I mean, we'll see. Hey, they sent Dynamite Kid, who could barely move out there at a TV taping, to get the belts off the Bulldogs and onto the Hart Foundation. All Dynamite had to do was get jumped on the outside and laid out for a few minutes. If Jeff can fly, they could get the belts on, I don't know, you know, Rusev and Nakamura, maybe, if they want to, because really, who else is there? Anderson and Gallows, they're off the list because they're likely gone later in the year. WWE won't even put them on the road anymore to give them those live event payoffs because they didn't sign new contracts. So they took them off the road. So as far as heel teams anyway, their options are very slim. If Jeff's not going to be gone for that long, you know what? It might just make sense to keep the belts on ice until he's ready to come back. Speaking of teams, no Heavy Machinery on the show last week either, but they are officially part of the SmackDown roster now, and they posted a video on YouTube of them in celebration of joining the SmackDown Live roster, walking around backstage with gift baskets filled with meat. They were giving people their meat. They gave them their meat. They gave their meat to Mandy Rose. I mean, how can you blame them? They gave their meat to Drake Maverick. They even gave their meat to Shane McMahon. Now you can see why this never aired on TV. The best part, though, came at the very end. They were all out of meat. They gave it all away. And Otis says, nothing makes people happier than a whole lot of meat inside them. I watched this on the bus ride into work in the morning, and I legitimately laughed out loud at the end of that video. If only people knew what I was laughing about, they probably would not want to sit near me anymore. Which actually is a great reason to go ahead and tell them. Sad tweet of the week is another example of how thin-skinned some people can be, or in this case, a wrestler turned referee. Apollo Crews responded to a fan. At WWE Factoids is the fan's Twitter handle. And this person asked Apollo, bro, when are you... Of course, I was gonna lapse into my accent here. Bro, when are you gonna be all business, bro? This ain't the Apollo Crews, bro, that I signed up to see, bro, okay? I used to watch the Night at the Apollo. I had Apollo Creed, and Rocky is one of my favorite characters, bro. Bro, when are we gonna see the Apollo Crews that I signed up to see, bro? Alright, so anyway, nothing egregiously bad with what the fan tweeted. Clearly, the guy is a fan of Apollo's work, and he has been disappointed in what he has seen from him on TV. Crews responded back, I'm always about my business. Don't ever get that twisted. Some things are out of my control. You read between the lines there, and you know what he means. He's not the only one creatively frustrated in that company. Where the sad tweet, though, comes from, it's not from Apollo, but from WWE referee Scott Armstrong, who also happens to be brothers with Road Dogg, Brian James. Armstrong responded to Apollo's tweet to say, and now you know why I already blocked that dude. What is it with these Armstrong boys that they're so sensitive? Look, I block people too, but there's usually a good reason for it, likely stupidity. That's probably my number one reason. I block a lot of stupid people. Or I mute them, which is even better. That's even better because then they talk to themselves without even knowing it. But there was absolutely nothing in what this guy said that was being overly disrespectful or harassing or anything. I even glanced at the guy's profile. I thought maybe, okay, maybe he's one of these people who goes around and he tags wrestlers and shit talks them on Twitter and is disrespectful. Nope. Just the opposite from what I saw. He actually seemed to be very respectful in a lot of his tweets. But you see, some of these people, if you question them or you question how they're being used, Apparently that gets you blocked. In this case, a secondhand block. It wasn't even from Apollo, it was from somebody else who had nothing to do with any of this. Other times, you'll get an honest answer about how your opinion isn't worth a thin dime.
Let me remind you, and I think a lot of people here will agree, NXT is way better than the WWE.
There were a couple of injuries at the NXT Omaha live event the other night. Raul Mendoza injured his leg or his ankle on a slide while running the ropes. His match with Jackson Ryker had to be stopped. He is due to be evaluated on Monday to see how serious it is. It doesn't sound like they expect it to be too serious, but we'll know more then. Unfortunately, the same cannot be said for Tom Caster during the Velveteen Dream North American title defense against Tyler Breeze. And yes, Tyler Breeze is back doing some NXT matches, which I'm sure he's very happy with, and I'm not being sarcastic when I say that. Referee Tom Caster broke his leg. He broke his ankle. I saw the video of the spot where it happened. Not the video that's been going around. It's another video that was shot of the exact injury when it happened. And it was on a spot where Breeze went to go super kick Velveteen Dream in the corner. And Dream dodged the kick and Breeze hit the referee with the super kick, which actually never even touched him. It never connected. But when the referee collapsed in selling it, his foot got caught underneath him and his leg just snapped. Sid style. Like, if you remember that sickening leg break from Sid Vicious in WCW, that this was the same kind of injury. Caster threw up the dreaded X for himself. Another referee, Drake Unger, ran in as planned to make the count for the near fall. He looked over. He knew right away that Caster was hurt. He also threw up the X. He was freaking out. He was waving for somebody to come on out, for a doctor to come out and help him. In the midst of all of this, Drake took a bump himself. So now he goes down. So with him down, Caster's the original referee. He's still laying in the corner. Nobody's there to help him. And with his ankle turned in the opposite direction, just dangling, he counted the fall after Dream hit Breeze with the Dream Valley Driver. He made the count. Now that's dedication. So hope all the best to him. He either is about to have surgery or has already had surgery. I don't know how long he'll be out for. I suspect it's going to be a while before he's back. And he will have a job waiting for him upon his return. The guy should have a job for life after that. They had tryouts at the Performance Center this week. They had 40 athletes training at the Performance Center, one of whom was Ivelisse Velez, who was in WWE developmental at one point, and there were a lot of rumors and a lot of stories about her attitude and that she rubbed people the wrong way and they cut her, and she's wrestled all over the place. She was in Lucha Underground. I became a big fan of her work in Lucha Underground and have been saying for a while that if she can get out of her contract with them, which she recently did, that WWE or NXT should be an easy landing spot for her. And we'll see what happens. I guess they're going to make their decision soon. People were upset that she had to try out. That's the way it works. You know, she is a veteran. She's been doing this now for a long time. She even wrestled for them before. But for her, it's like starting from the bottom all over again. You've got to start from the bottom and you got to try out and audition just like everybody else would. And it is interesting to note, I was not aware of this. I was not aware of the heat between Ivelisse and Mia Yim. Until this week, I was smartened up when I saw somebody tweeted Mia, you know, talking about Ivelisse and saying how, oh, hopefully she gets a shot, even if they just bring her in and put her in a team with Mia Yim and they can go after Kairi and Asuka. And Mia responded by saying, no thanks. And I didn't quite understand where that was coming from until I looked around and read up on it. And far be it from me to be spreading personal private gossip, but my understanding is that it has to do with an incident many years ago with Mia's then boyfriend and, you know, possibly getting with Ivelisse. And so I could understand if that's what happened, I can understand why there would be bad blood there. And that could make for a very uncomfortable environment if the two of them are both roaming around the PC very soon. So a few thoughts from this week's NXT television show. They had a tag team match with Casey Catanzaro and Candice LeRae against Aaliyah and Vanessa Bourne. And when Casey was in the ring with Aaliyah, Mauro Ranallo referred to Casey going up against, quote, the veteran Aaliyah. The veteran Aaliyah. How old am I that she has become the veteran Aaliyah? That's such a stretch that DDP would be proud. The veteran Aaliyah. I almost fell out of my chair when I heard Mauro say that. Anyway, Candice pinned Bourne with the quebrada off the rope. I love the height that she gets on that quebrada, by the way. Kushida. From quebrada to Kushida. Kushida's coming next week. Cassius Ohno barged into William Regal's office, and he pitched for himself to be Kushida's first opponent. Regal later on obliged, and so we are going to get Kushida in his debut this upcoming Wednesday against Cassius Ohno. We had a really fun match between the War Raiders. Yes, under that name, the NXT Tag Team Champions, the War Raiders, against the Street Profits. This was a sprint right from the word go. There was no moment of wasted action or a dull moment here in this match. These two teams went right after each other. In fact, right from the start of the match, the Street Profits went after the champions. Montez Ford hit this gigantic frog splash off the top. Nobody gets more height on that frog splash than Montez Ford. The guy is going to get lost in the lights one of these days. And he hit it right away. They were all, if you didn't know any better, and I don't know when this was taped, but if you didn't know any better, and you only knew that the War Raiders have been promoted to the main roster, you might have thought that that was going to be it. And they were going to take the titles off them in the first 20 seconds of the match. But they kicked out. And in the end, the War Raiders got the win. They did not do a title change here on the show. But I thought both teams looked great. I thought this was a lot of fun. I still weep for what might be to come with these guys on the main roster. Look, I have every right to feel that way. You look at the track record. Now, I'm not just saying track record of NXT talent on the main roster. There are some NXT guys who go on to greatness on the main roster. The track record of tag teams, though, going from NXT to the main roster is not good. It's not good. And we'll see if Heavy Machinery can buck that trend. They certainly haven't done much so far. You think of the Ascension, you look at the Revival. You know, the fact that those guys got one foot out the door tells you all you need to know there. I don't know, what makes you think that the War Raiders, they can't even get their fucking name right, what makes you think that they're going to be any different? Everything about them here on this show, from the name to the entrance, they have that video, you know, the video wall entrance with the flame and everything. I watched their entrance on this show. And their entrance, just the entrance this week, was better than anything that I've seen them do in their first 2 weeks on television. They strip a lot of that away when you make it to the main roster when there's no reason for them to do so. They could easily carry a lot of this stuff over to the main roster. And they're very talented. So if you are a believer that the cream always rises to the top, then those guys should do great because they're very good. But the cream does not always rise to the top. You and I know that's bullshit. The cream does not always rise to the top. Think of how many talented guys never got a chance, never stood a chance on the main roster. So I hope for their sake that they are the exception and not the rule, but it actually kind of made me sad watching this. As good as this was, it made me sad to watch it. Johnny Gargano against Roderick Strong, non-title main event. Gargano got to fulfill a childhood dream of his this past Wednesday when he threw out the ceremonial first pitch before the Cleveland Indians game in his hometown of Cleveland, Ohio. They even acknowledged him as a Triple Crown winner up on the Jumbotron. Unfortunately, they acknowledged him as a WCW Triple Crown winner, not an NXT Triple Crown winner, which is an alternate timeline of wrestling history I wasn't aware of. Johnny Gargano was a Triple Crown winner in WCW. Dude looks good for his age. Dude looks good for his age. Anyway, him and Roddy, this was good. Gargano escape brings out Adam Cole, Kyle O'Reilly, and Bobby Fish. And then Matt Riddle to fend them off. Riddle had a run-in backstage earlier in the show with Adam Cole while Cole was in the middle of a photo shoot. So Riddle fought off Fish and O'Reilly. Cole nailed him. And then he turned around to deliver a super kick to who he thought was Johnny Gargano, but actually turned out to be Roderick Strong sticking his head through the ropes, and he kicked Roddy in the head. Gargano then hit a tope through the ropes, wiped out Adam Cole, hit the slingshot DDT for the win, and so we had dissension after the match in the ranks of Undisputed Era. Roddy was not happy about the miscommunication costing him the win. I said this before, I really hope they don't break these guys up before they hit the main roster, because they are going to get called up at some point. Maybe not together, maybe not collectively as a group. I think that would be a mistake. I think you keep them together. Now, you can tease dissension, but in the end, they don't actually break up. Hopefully, that's all that's going on here. Maybe there'll be some dissension for a while. Maybe we'll get an Adam Cole, Roderick Strong match, but in the end, the Undisputed Era sticks together, because I do think that they are stronger together as a unit than they would be if they were split up and then called up. I think for some of them, that would just be death if that happened. Let's get to your mailbag questions. You can email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from. When you write in, we'll start with Curtis from Toronto. After last week's podcast and you talking about the Montreal screwjob, I went down the rabbit hole when it came to videos about the incident. I watched one where Vince McMahon was talking about what happened backstage and said that right before Brett punched him, he had his ankle stepped on and broken, and that's why he went down so easily. Do you know if this actually happened, or is this Vince's way of trying to save face and not come across as weak for getting KO'd by Brett? And here you thought you were done with Montreal. Funny. Well, the long-standing story about what happened is actually kind of funny. It's that Brett punched Vince. Shane was there. So his son was there in the locker room along with Briscoe. I don't know if Slaughter was there. But Shane jumped on Brett. Bulldog was nearby. He pulled Shane off of Brett. Bulldog had already taken his knee brace off. And in grabbing Shane, he hyperextended his knee in the scuffle. Brett asked Vince, as he was lying there, if he was going to screw him on all the money he owed him now. And Vince said no. And Brett told Shane and Briscoe to get that piece of shit out of here. And in dragging Vince away, someone, and I believe it may have been Jerry Briscoe, accidentally stepped on Vince's ankle. I don't know if he broke it or not, but he stepped on Vince's ankle. If you watch Wrestling with Shadows, when Vince walks out of the dressing room down the hallway, he's clearly limping. So again, I don't know if the ankle was broken, but it was definitely injured. But it was like this comedy of errors that happened, right? So from the initial punch to Shane going after Brett or tackling him, and the Bulldog took his brace off, and then he ends up getting hurt and hyperextending his knee. And then Briscoe steps on Vince's ankle. I mean, I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall for all of this. But that's been the story for years as far as what happened. And, you know, if he did hurt his ankle then, it happened well after the punch. So he can try to explain it away all he wants to save face. I think that's really all that was. He was taking a bit of truth about his ankle being hurt, but he was making it sound like, well, that's the only reason why. Yeah, not really. You got sucker punched, dude. That's what happened. And it was one of his own men who did it. It was one of his own men who stepped on his ankle. Alex from Detroit, there's a video on Facebook showing Eddie Guerrero in a match with JBL and the Dudley Boys on SmackDown. During the match, it looks like Eddie is in real trouble, and then JBL tags himself in and pins Eddie and forces the ref to count three. Do you know if Eddie really had a heart attack here? This was during a time when I wasn't really watching WWE. When I read the comments on the video, I saw a lot of the same comments that Scott Hall made when he was talking about Montreal, about camera angles and zooming in on Eddie when they should have been getting him help. Do you know anything about this? It was all staged. It was all part of the storyline. He did not actually have a heart attack in the ring. All the zooms and the cuts on a taped show, no less. I mean, that should have been a dead giveaway. Yeah, if the guy had a heart attack, they're not going to be zooming in on him, and he's not going to be... It's just, if you go back and watch the segment, you'll know what I'm talking about. You can just watch and know that it's all just a work, and that's all that was. Speaking of Eddie, Marcus in Toronto. Another Canuck. The site of SummerSlam this year, by the way, Toronto, Ontario, Canada. He wants to know my thoughts on Vicky Guerrero's comments from her interview with Chris Van Vliet that she would like to see Chris Benoit inducted one day into the WWE Hall of Fame. First of all, let me just say this, that Chris has done a couple of really great interviews recently. You should all check out the 35-minute one that he did with Tony Khan about All Elite Wrestling, and he just published a new one with Vicky. And this is where Vicky made the remark, and actually I pulled the exact quote. So this is exactly what she said. She was asked about this. She did not bring this up herself. She did not volunteer this information. The question was asked of her, and this was her response. "It's a sad situation. I loved Chris Benoit. His family was our family. His wife Nancy, we were very close, and their son Daniel. I wasn't there when it happened, and I don't understand why it happened, but I still love him. Aside from all that, he loved us, and he respected us. He was a talented wrestler, and he had his own legacy, and I think that it should not be ignored, and it is sad how things turned out, but I would like to see him inducted into the Hall of Fame." Now, Vicky was married to Eddie. Eddie was best friends with Chris, and so I'm sure they knew their families, they knew each other, and there was a love there. And I'm sure that it was as difficult for Benoit's family and Nancy's family. It was also very tough, I'm sure, for the people who knew Eddie or who were related to Eddie and got to know Chris's family as well. I can't imagine what it was like for them when they found out the news of what had happened. It's awful. It's just awful. Even all these years later to think about it, it gives me a shudder to think about what happened. And as far as Benoit is concerned, a lot of people will not even watch his matches anymore. They either refuse to, or they just can't. It's too depressing, and they just won't watch any Chris Benoit matches at all. I do not fall into that camp. If I'm watching an old episode of Nitro, or I'm looking up old WCW clips online for some reason, and there's Benoit when he was part of the Horsemen, or, hey, here's the Benoit match with Kevin Sullivan from the Great American Bash in 1996, doesn't bother me. I can go back and enjoy it for what it was and just, you know, kind of in that moment when I'm watching the matches, I can kind of separate myself out of the reality and just enjoy the match for what it is. That is very different than saying I think he should be inducted into the Hall of Fame. And I cannot even believe, especially somebody like Vicky, who I would think would be an intelligent woman, I cannot even believe that after all of these years, there are people either still advocating for this or, and I don't know if she was advocating or just saying that she hopes it happens, but I cannot believe that there are people either advocating for it or who honestly believe that it will one day happen. It will never, ever happen. Let's put this to bed once and for all. Chris Benoit should not and will not ever be inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame. I cannot even believe there are people who still ask the question or who give that kind of an answer. I don't care how close you might have been to him. If you knew him personally, you have a different perspective on things. You have a different opinion about things. You're entitled to that opinion. What you are missing the point on is this. And there are people who will say, well, you know, Solomonster, there's a lot of other really bad people in the Hall of Fame. Moolah's in the Hall of Fame and all the stuff she's rumored to have done. Jimmy Snuka probably killed a woman. You're right. You're absolutely right. And it's a shame that more people were not aware of that story. It was a very local story for a number of years in Pennsylvania, I think it was. You didn't have, the internet was not as ubiquitous as it is now. You couldn't just go on social media on your device and read about all these things and go on Wikipedia and look up his bio and look up his entry. So a lot of people did not even know about the incident, let alone that he killed this woman. And I believe that he did. I mean, obviously, it was never proven beyond a shadow of a doubt. Believe what you want to believe. I believe that he murdered that woman. And if it were up to me, he would not be in the WWE Hall of Fame. He would never have been inducted in the first place. The difference is that you have people like him who have already been put into the Hall of Fame. They're not going to be taken out. Moolah, you know, and all the rumors around her, they're already in the Hall of Fame. But that does not mean that, well, because they're in the Hall of Fame, well, Chris Benoit deserves to be in the Hall of Fame. Had Chris Benoit already been in the Hall of Fame, we wouldn't even be having this conversation right now. He'd be in the Hall of Fame. That would be it. But because he wasn't, and he committed these horrible crimes, whatever his motivations were, wherever his mind was at the moment, it does not matter. He killed two people. He murdered his child. What don't you understand about this? If he is not already in the Hall of Fame, he will never be in the Hall of Fame. Can you even imagine WWE thinking about doing such a thing? The outcry, the publicity that they would get out of it. Seth Rollins goes around and says, burn it down. Yeah, there's an example of burning it down. You want to burn your whole company down? Go ahead and induct Chris Benoit into the Hall of Fame. Are you that dense? I just can't even believe that this is even still a question anymore. He did what he did. There's no ignoring it. You can't separate what he did from his wrestling accomplishments and say, well, we could just put him in as a wrestler. That's not how this works. That is not how any of this works. So no, he will not be in the Hall of Fame. He should not be in the Hall of Fame. And I think that was a really dumb thing for her to say. And she's entitled to, if that's how she feels, she still has a love in her heart for Chris Benoit, then that's great. But to even insinuate that WWE, enough time will go by. Maybe 10 years from now, things will have died down a little bit more. Those people will be a little less dead. And then we'll put Chris Benoit in the Hall of Fame and celebrate him. Because that's what it is, right? You put somebody in the Hall of Fame, you're celebrating them. You're celebrating their career. This is not a man who deserves to be celebrated. That went out the window when he did what he did. You can quietly celebrate his career by watching old Chris Benoit matches and talking about what a great wrestler he was. But the Hall of Fame is a non-starter, and nobody should be bringing it up because it ain't gonna happen. And it shouldn't. Period. End of story. Full stop. Jason from Jersey. Would you be willing to say that September 22nd, 1997 was the most important night in the modern era? From the WCW side, it was the debut of Bill Goldberg, with WWE having Vince McMahon eat his first stunner, not to mention the debut on WWE TV of Cactus Jack. If not this night, then when else? I don't know how far back you consider the modern era. I hear that term used a lot. What does that even mean, really? Let's assume you mean from the start of the Monday Night War. The most important night, then, I would say, was probably the Raw Nitro simulcast in March of 2001, when WWE bought WCW. It marked one of the worst things to happen in the wrestling business. I'd call that a pretty important night. But September 22nd, 1997 is a good choice, too, for all the reasons you mentioned. And one other thing happened that night, as the story goes. That was the night they were at Madison Square Garden for Raw. It was before that show, at the building that night, that Vince McMahon allegedly approached Bret Hart about breaching his contract because he could no longer afford to pay him on his big new contract that he gave him the year before. And so began the build to what would end up being the Montreal Screwjob, where Bret went and he negotiated a deal with Eric Bischoff to jump to WCW, and we all know what happened after that. But it was at the Garden that night that Vince approached Bret about not being able to pay him on his contract. And I'll throw one more in for you. So beyond September 22nd of 97, I would throw in January 4th of 1999, the night Mankind won the WWF title, or at least his win aired. It was taped the week before. So technically, Foley won the championship in 98, but it did not air until the following year. But that was the night that his title win aired over The Rock. And, you know, this was after Tony Schiavone on Nitro spoiled the outcome and made the sarcastic comment about how that'll put the butts in seats. And then later that night on Nitro, they did the finger poke of doom with Hulk Hogan and Kevin Nash, and WCW was never the same after that. The gap widened between the two companies after that night. Of those three, if I had to pick one, I say the WCW date was the most important, the simulcast, just because of what it signified. Matt from St. John's, Newfoundland, Canada, do you think WWE should bring back time limits in their matches and end certain matches every now and then with a time limit draw? Yes, I do. I think that would be a great idea. Every now and then, when they want to do some kind of a time limit finish, it won't be as obvious, right? Because they never acknowledge time limits at all. So I don't even think they exist in modern day WWE. Every now and again, they'll want to do a match or an angle where it goes the distance. Time runs out, 30 minutes, 60 minutes, whatever it is. And if they go out of their way to announce the fact that there is a time limit before the match starts, well, that's a dead giveaway that it's going to factor into the finish, because when else do they ever say anything about time limits? If time limits just become a normal, everyday part of the product again, even if they're never used and matches still rarely go to a draw, at least you're acknowledging it. It doesn't give it away when the time comes that you do want to do some kind of a finish like that. So I agree with you 100%. I think it would be smart. It could just be a little thing that they just start to incorporate at the beginning of the match announcements. I think it would be a smart thing to do. Dan from Niagara Falls, New York. If Bobby Heenan's greatest call is the 1992 Royal Rumble match and Jim Ross's greatest call is the 1998 King of the Ring Hell in a Cell match, which match do you believe to be Michael Cole's greatest called match? I remember Michael Cole being really good during his run with Taz on SmackDown. Me personally, I would say the night Eddie Guerrero won the belt from Brock Lesnar at No Way Out 2004 was Cole at his best. What say you, and who do you think would be his best replacement when he eventually steps down from commentary? I can't say that Michael Cole has really had that one defining match call. You know, the Brock match was a good one. I guess that's as good as any I could think of. The Money in the Bank match with John Cena against CM Punk, I remember him being pretty good during that match. But I don't think Cole has really ever had that one defining performance on commentary like Jim Ross. He's had moments, you know, the whole Miracle on Bourbon Street thing, the line at the end of the main event of WrestleMania 30 when Daniel Bryan won the championship. That was memorable when Seth Rollins cashed in Money in the Bank the year after that, calling it the heist of the century. Like, I could think of moments and lines that Cole has, you know, that of his that stand out to me. I can point to a few specific moments like that, but when I think of a complete match that he called that really stands out to me as some sort of career-defining call or one that's going to be remembered for years to come, even now after 20 years he's been working for this company, I can't think of one that really stands out like that to me. As far as who I think would be the best replacement for him when he's ready to step down, I don't think that person is necessarily working for WWE right now. And I'll leave it at that. John from New Jersey, buy or sell on who was WWE's MVP of 1997? Bret Hart, Shawn Michaels, The Undertaker, or Stone Cold Steve Austin? I'm going to buy on Bret Hart. Without a doubt, Bret's descent from babyface to anti-American foreign heel is one of the greatest character turns in the history of that company. And WWE is worse off without him in 97, I think, more so than any of those other three. His match with Stone Cold at WrestleMania 13 is one of the greatest matches of all time, and wasn't even supposed to happen originally. And he did more to help put over Steve Austin, I think, than maybe any other single person. Not even I think, I know. More than any other single person, aside from Vince, of course, who, you know, booked him to be a big star and worked with him, and Vince sacrificed himself, made himself look like an ass every week to help get Austin over. I guess you put Vince at number one, but aside from Vince, I think in terms of other workers, Bret did more than any other single person to help elevate Austin to that next level. And a lot of that happened in 97 with that WrestleMania match and the fallout from that WrestleMania match when Austin was feuding with the Hart Foundation. So there's that, there's the heel turn, there's the formation of the Hart Foundation faction, him winning the championship at SummerSlam. He was the MVP of that year in WWE, hands down, Bret Hart. And we'll end with this. Josh from Steventown. My 32nd birthday this year also marked the 5-year anniversary of the Ultimate Warrior's passing. He was my favorite wrestler of all time, so to hear that he passed away broke my heart. What is your favorite Warrior match, and what was your favorite Warrior promo? I struggled a little bit with the favorite match because it's a coin toss between WrestleMania 6 and WrestleMania 7. You know, growing up as a young wrestling fan, Hogan Warrior champ versus champ, title for title, was bigger than anything. And it turned out to be a much better match, I think, than people probably expected it to be. But that match with Savage, the career-ending match of WrestleMania 7, right through what happened post-match with Sherry and Liz, I mean, it was just... it was wrestling bliss, it really was, and those are easily the two best matches that the Warrior ever had. I'll go at WrestleMania 7. I think it was, you cannot go wrong picking that to be Warrior's best match, him and Savage. As far as the best Warrior promo, that's look, he certainly had a lot of very entertaining promos, even if you didn't quite understand what it was that he was saying. And I remember him having some promos where he was very coherent and very calm. And when he came back in 96, he had that one promo on TV when he was feuding with Goldust, and he had that line, you know, I got a full-length action movie for you, me kicking your ass from beginning to end. Like, he had some cool lines like that. The promo that stands out to me as probably being my favorite was probably at the peak of all of his coked-out greatness. I'm sure everybody was on coke back in the 80s, especially in that company. But it was a promo that aired on Primetime Wrestling. This was right before the Survivor Series in 1989. There was an elimination match. Warrior was the captain of his own team. It was the Ultimate Warriors. It was him and Jim Neidhart, Marty Jannetty, and Shawn Michaels. They were going to take on the Heenan family. They had a backstage. It was one of these promos with the backdrop and everything where they're just talking about their upcoming Survivor Series match. And I think the Anvil started talking, and then Jannetty, and then Michaels, and then it would go to the Warrior at the end. But while Anvil and the Rockers were cutting their promo, the Warrior, who's just jacked to the gills, and just, it's insane. To look at the guy is just insane. But he's got a roll of athletic tape. And he begins to, he's walking in circles around his partners, and he is wrapping them. He is tying them up with the athletic tape. And he's going round and around, and he's wrapping it around their bodies, and he starts wrapping it around their heads and their throat. Shawn Michaels is trying to cut a promo. He looks absolutely just scared for his life. He doesn't know what's going on here. He legitimately looked afraid for his life, especially when the tape was being wrapped around his throat. He kind of freaked out a little bit. They're looking at the Warrior like, what the fuck is this guy on? He's tying us up. Just, you gotta go find that promo or watch it, just for Shawn's reaction alone. He looked like he was just fearing for his life. And then finally they get to the Warrior. Now everybody's all tied up, and the Warrior starts cutting his promo, and it is just the peak of what you would remember the Warrior and his promos being back in the 80s. He himself has the tape wrapped around him, and just the way that he is speaking, it looks like he's getting off. The way that he is speaking, this, the first thing that popped in my head was autoerotic asphyxiation. That's what's going on here in this promo. He has all of these guys wrapped up, and I can only imagine some of the things that this guy was probably into. I don't even want to know. I think we got a glimpse of it here watching this promo. It's hilarious as all hell, but also kind of disturbing in a way. So if you want to go find it, I don't remember, I don't know what episode it would have been at primetime, but it would have been in November of 89, right before the Survivor Series. Or maybe if you type in Ultimate Warrior Athletic Tape or something, it might come up. But it was, it's the one that really stands out to me more than, even more than the ones about Hogan and the plane going down, Hulk Hogan and all that stuff. That was disturbing in a different way. But this one, it was like, these guys are just trying to get through the promo without dying. And it's pretty funny stuff. So that would be my favorite Warrior promo. That wraps up the mailbag here for this week. Keep sending in your questions. TheSolomonster@gmail.com is the place to send all of your letters and questions and comments and suggestions and lottery numbers and all that good stuff. Make a PayPal donation. TheSolomonster.com is the place to do so. You can follow me on Twitter @Solomonster. Is my handle on there. And please subscribe to the YouTube channel, youtube.com/TheSolomonster. You'll see the official channel. We are getting very close to 49,000 subs, which of course brings us to within 1,000 of 50K, which is pretty exciting stuff. And I'm going to have something to announce next week as it pertains to the YouTube channel. So you want to stay tuned for that. I will be back for episode 598 next Sunday. Until then, be well, stay safe, have yourselves a great week. May you have a better week than the New York Giants had in the NFL draft. And I will see you back here next Sunday. Take care, guys.
The Solomonster sounds off.
Harlem Heat 2000, Techno Team 2000, LOD 2000, WrestleMania 2000. Anything as a rule of thumb with 2000 in the name, you know it sucked.
The Solomonster Sounds Off, available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and now Pandora.
Want more content?
Visit YouTube.com/TheSolomonster for Sound Off extras and more. And follow The Solomonster on Twitter at Solomonster.
Solomonster.
Put that cigarette out.
Solomonster Sounds Off.